Shalom. Hello, today
we'll be reading the last chapter of the book, The Jewish Choice, Unity or Antisemitism. You can send us questions live on kab.tv. You can find our texts on kabbalahmedia.info. Chapter 9, Toward a Conscious Jewish People. I'll just say before starting the translation that the Hebrew text was heavily edited with paragraphs omitted all together and so on, so the text may deviate. I won't be reading it exactly as is written in the English version. I'll be following the Hebrew. In the transfer agreement, Edwin Black points to the heart of the problem in facing the threat of Nazi Germany, Jewish disunity. However, he makes an allowance to the Jews when he says that they were in good company, that the whole world was bewildered in the face of Nazism. In Black's words, the Jews were the first to recognize Hitler's threat and the first to react to that threat. The fact that they were foiled by their own disunity merely puts them in the company of all of mankind. Who did not confront the Hitler menace with indecision? Who did not seal pacts of expediency with the Third Reich? The Catholic Church, the Lutheran Church, and the Supreme Muslim Council all endorsed the Hitler regime. The United States, England, France, Italy, Russia, Argentina, Japan, Ireland, Poland, and dozens of other nations all signed friendship and trade treaties and knowingly contributed to the German economic and military recovery. The international banking and commercial community also saw Germany as indispensable to its salvation. But while everyone benefited from Nazi Germany, the Jews were in a different situation. They were the only ones with a gun to their heads. But since the end of World War II and until today, many good things have happened to the Jewish people. The State of Israel was established, American Jewry has acquired an unprecedented status in American culture, politics, finance, and economy, and the remnants of European Jewry seem to have found peace and prosperity once more in France, Germany, and other West European countries. At the same time, Russian Jewry has been liberated, and today Jews are free to live wherever they choose in the non-Muslim world. Our memory is short. We tend to relate to the Holocaust as a chapter in our past, which, however tragic, will not return. But history is not on our side. It has shown time and again that our disunity yields disaster. And the greater our disunity, the greater is our calamity. In today's globalized world, we cannot speak of American Jewry, the State of Israel, German Jewry, or French Jewry as separate entities. Just as the world has become a global village, so Jewry has become world Jewry, and the fate of our entire nation is irreversibly linked to the conduct of each of our communities, just as the fate of each Jewish community is irreversibly linked to our conduct as an entire nation. Notwithstanding, if only by their sheer size and predominance, today's two major Jewish communities, the one in America and the one in the State of Israel, have a much greater impact on the fate of world Jewry, and therefore bear a much heavier responsibility for the future of our nation. But now that we have seen the consequences of our separation, we can make a conscious choice. In this final chapter, we will examine our options, for the coming years in light of everything that we have seen happen to us from the inception of our people to the present. Subheading: A Warm Welcome. On November 29th, 29th, 1947, the UN General Assembly voted in favor of a resolution which adopted the plan for the partition of Palestine recommended by the majority of the UN Special Committee on Palestine. 33 states voted in favor of the resolution and 13 against. 10 states abstained. The UN committee reached the conclusion that the mandate for Palestine should be terminated, and most of its members recommended the establishment in the territory of mandatory Palestine of an Arab state and a Jewish state. That UN resolution, which became known as Resolution 181, set off Israel's war of independence. In the midst of the battles, on the day the British mandate over Palestine expired, Friday, May 14th, 1948, the Jewish People's Council gathered in the Tel Aviv Museum to declare the establishment of the State of Israel. At the time of the declaration, the fledgling state was under attack from every direction, surrounded by the armies of 7 Arab nations and enemies within its own territory. Yet, the Jews had 2 things going for them. 1, they put aside their differences and united their paramilitary organizations into the Israel Defense Force, or the IDF. 2, they had no choice. The Holocaust was the proof that if they did not win this war, they would not only lose the land, but their very lives. Also, in the short burst of sympathy toward the Jews after the horrors of the Holocaust became known, the world was shortly with them. The new state was recognized that night, May 14, 1948, by the United States, and 3 days later by the USSR. The support for the tiny Jewish state came from many countries and lasted roughly 19 years, until after the Six-Day War in June 1967. In fact, probably one of the most supportive countries of the State of Israel was Germany. Officially, West Germany maintained a policy of neutrality so as not to risk its political and commercial relationship with the oil-rich Arab countries. But when Israel launched a surprise attack that freed it from the chokehold of the Egyptian army and began the Six-Day War, Germany was so thrilled it could not hide it. When war erupted, writes historian Carol Fink, the SPD, the Social Democratic Party, faction leader Helmut Schmidt, who a year earlier had made an extended visit to Israel, insisted, "Much as we value the traditional friendship of our people with the Arab peoples, we must protest the intention of their leaders to destroy Israel." When it came his time to speak, Brandt, the leader of the Social Democratic Party, although reiterating his government's official policy of non-intervention, stated that this did not mean moral indifference or neutrality of the heart. "There were strong expressions of popular support for Israel," continues Fink. 300 West Berlin youths volunteered for civilian service in Israel. In Frankfurt, the bank Vorgemeinwirtschaft purchased Israeli bonds valued at 3 million Deutsche Mark, and the city donated an additional 30,000 Deutsche Mark from its budget. In Hamburg and Stuttgart, doctors donated some 65,000 Deutsche Mark in medical and pharmaceutical supplies. In Bonn, then the capital of West Germany, some 1,000 doctors, nurses, workers, soldiers, and young people offered their services to the Israeli embassy, which also received several thousand letters, including financial donations. Professor Fink also writes that Israel's unanticipated and overwhelming military victory created a wave of relief in Germany. Acclaimed novelist and playwright Günter Grass joyfully announced, "A new situation has emerged to express our solidarity for Israel and the fate of the Jews without our feelings being hindered by the past." Likewise, in his passionate editorial on June 10th, Rudolf Augustin, editor of Der Spiegel, rejoiced that the Arab attempt to wipe out Israel had failed. They rolled like Rommel, won as Patton, and sang at that. This is a singing army. Here the text deviates. They shoot the pan-Arab prophets from their dreams of dominance and overthrew Egypt's Nasser into the depths of the Nile. Pharaoh took responsibility for the lost war and submitted his resignation. Subtitle, Pride and Punishment. Israel's unequivocal victory in the Six-Day War secured Israel's existence and gave it a strategic breathing space that it did not have before. Prior to the war, the distance in some places between the eastern border with Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea was 6 miles. In northern Israel, the Syrians controlled the strategically dominating Golan Heights all the way down to the Sea of Galilee. This enabled them, should they choose, to simply drive their tanks through the narrow strip that is northern Israel and within an hour reach the Lebanese border, thereby disconnecting northern Israel from the rest of the country. In the south, the conquest of Sinai moved the Egyptian army further away from the Tel Aviv metropolis, the hub of Israel's business life and economy. The expansion of the country brought with it a tactical relief and room to maneuver in the case of war. However, the military victory had two major negative consequences whose impact is only worsening over time. The first consequence was a shift in the way the world perceives Israel, from being perceived as a victim to being perceived as a villain. The second and perhaps worst consequence of all was pride. In the war, Israel suddenly became the conqueror of territories filled with civilian population, and the governing power of holy sites such as the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron. Israelis were amazed at their own military might, of which they had no idea, and became overconfident and arrogant. Worse yet, the false sense of omnipotence soon spilled over from the military into civilian life, and deepening social rifts began to emerge in the Israeli society, which was still very much a nation of immigrants from numerous countries and cultures. It is not as though the rifts between immigrants from different countries did not exist prior to the Six-Day War. But the sense of complacency and confidence in Israel's military might allowed Israelis to emphasize these differences, and not in order to unite above them, but rather to patronize other factions in the population. The October 1973 surprise attack of the Egyptian and Syrian armies in what became known as the Yom Kippur War, or the October War, found Israel completely unprepared. The intelligence misread the intentions of Israel's enemies, and the hubris of the political establishment resulted in a hard and painful awakening. It reminded Israelis that a strong army was not a guarantee for peace. However, the turmoil of the war did not mend the growing chasms in Israeli society. If anything, it deepened them. As always, when Israel are divided, the world turns against them. As the rifts that began to appear after the Six-Day War continued to deepen, the tone toward as the rifts that began to appear after the Six-Day War continued to deepen, the tone toward Israel became increasingly critical and angry. Today, with the Israeli society being more fractured than ever, the situation of the State of Israel in the international arena is so dire that if the vote on the establishment of the Jewish state were to be taken these days, very few countries, if any, would vote in favor of it. Still, the struggles within Israel's political parties and the alienation between the various factions of society keep growing. And the more they do, the more the nations despise and loathe Israel, regardless of its efforts to please and appease the world. As has always happened, when Israel fight among themselves, the nations fight against them too. Continued deterioration of the disunity and strife within Israeli society, therefore, will inevitably lead to a disaster that will come to Israel at the hands of the nations. Each tragedy in human history has its own characteristics and phases of development, but the one gauge that determines the intensity of a tragedy to the Jewish people, in specific, is the level of animosity within the tribe, and in the case of Israel, within the Israeli society. Add to this the abyss that has grown between American Jewry and the State of Israel, and you have a looming perfect storm whose outcome is anyone's guess, but which will no doubt be inconceivably horrific.
Mein Chef Legit.
What should I? What do I need to say? If there are any questions, please. It's just facts we were already in. Yeah, let's continue.
The Jewish American Dream. Much like 15th century Spain and 20th century Germany, American Jewry has abandoned the aspiration to return to Zion. Moreover, young American Jews are turning their backs on the Jewish state altogether, and in many cases, on their own Jewishness. Like the German Jews before them, they have made New York City their new Jerusalem. Much like the mutual odium between the conversos and Jews in Spain, between the Orthodox Jews and assimilationist Jews in Germany, or between both groups and the Zionist Jews, today's American Jewry is divided within itself into factions and groups that simply cannot stand one another. Until relatively recently, the mutual disdain was mainly between Orthodox Jews and most other Jewish denominations. But especially since the 2016 elections campaign, the rift between supporters of the Democratic Party and supporters of the Conservative Party has also deepened to the point that political conscious Jews, and most Jews are politically conscious, often hate their fellow tribes members who support the other party merely for their political views. Additionally, if previously there were tensions between American Jewry and the Jewish state of Israel, today the schism has grown to a point where it seems it can no longer be bridged. As leading Jewish organizations are adopting increasingly pro-Palestinian and anti-Zionist agendas, the gulf keeps growing and is already threatening the very fabric of our nation.
מאמצים אג'נדות פרו-פלסטיניות ואנטי-ציוניות קיצוניות יותר, כך התהום מתרחבת ומאיימת על המרקם העדין והחיוני של האומה שלנו.
No one is right, everyone is wrong. In the struggle to prove agendas and approaches, the factions of our nation forget that it is not because we are conservative or democratic, religious, secular, or anything in between, that the nations torment us every so often. It is because we are Jews. More accurately, it is because we are disunited Jews. Our division as a nation brings upon us calamity after calamity, and today's level of internal antipathy is at such levels that the next cataclysm in the sad, painful, and bloody annals of our history, of our people, is well within sight. The text deviates here. Here, throughout the ages, the spiritual leaders of our people warned us time and again that unless we unite, we would suffer. Throughout the ages, we would not listen. Today, the price for not listening will, in all likelihood, be too heavy to bear. Okay, the text skips ahead again. The prime defense against calamity, or rather it doesn't, the prime defense against calamity is love and unity. When there are love, unity, and friendship between each other in Israel, no calamity can come over them. If there is bonding among them and no separation of hearts, they have peace and quiet, and all the curses and suffering are removed by that unity. These words of wisdom that the author of Maor Vashemesh, Light and Sun, wrote centuries ago, are just as true today, if not more so. Similarly, the book of Maor Enayim stresses, when one includes oneself with all of Israel and unity is made, at that time no harm shall come to you. And the book Shem Mishmuel adds, when Israel are as one man with one heart, they are as as a fortified wall against the force of evil. Unity, a tool to accomplish a mission. At the end of chapter 1, we mentioned historian Paul Johnson, who wrote that the early Jews had detected a divine scheme for the human race, of which their own society was to be a pilot. That scheme was never a secret, nor was it its nature. Our forefathers knew that their success depended on their unity, although they often failed to maintain it. Nevertheless, when strife among them struck, they knew its cause was the intensification of the ego, and they knew what they had to do in order to correct it. Moses demanded that the people unite as one man with one heart, if they were to merit receiving the Torah, the law of unity, by which they became a nation worthy of being a role model people, a light unto nations. Likewise, King Solomon stated very clearly how people should relate to the hatred that erupts among them, despite their efforts to unite. Hate stirs strife, and love will cover all crimes. This strategy... text deviates. Our natural tendency is to stifle hatred and pretend that it does not exist until the next time it erupts, and usually more forcefully. That since the inception of the nation, its leaders and educational texts repeatedly reiterated the importance of doing so. Perhaps this need to reiterate the importance of rising above conflicts rather than repressing them can explain the existence of such enigmatic statements in the Book of Zohar, the seminal book in Kabbalah, as this one. All the wars in the Torah are peace and love. Or this poetic excerpt, behold how good and how pleasant it is for brothers to also sit together. These are the friends, as they sit together and are not separated from one another. At first, they seem like people at war, wishing to kill one another. Then, they return to being in brotherly love. And you, the friends who are here, as you were in fondness and love before, henceforth you will also not part from one another, and by your merit there will be peace in the world. From the very beginning, unity was not an end in itself, but a means to a much greater goal. When Abraham first introduced the method of uniting above hatred and separation to his Babylonian country folk, they rejected him and ejected him from their land. But the people who followed him, precisely because of this social doctrine, grew and strengthened, as elaborated in chapter 1, and their cohesion made them increasingly more potent until they became a nation, the Israeli people. The official inauguration of the Jewish people happened at the foot of Mount Sinai, when the people united as one man with one heart, and subsequently received the law, the Torah, of which the fundamental rule is love your neighbor as yourself. Only then could the people be told, this day you have become a nation. Since then, as we have seen throughout this book, the annals of the Jewish people have been a procession of periods of internal strife, disunity, and subsequent affliction, followed by temporary and mostly partial reestablishment of unity and subsequent relative peace and prosperity. Until the 20th century, the previous century saw meteoric developments in technology, industry and economy. Aviation became accessible to everyone. Space became the final frontier, and even the moon was no longer out of reach. Cars, phones, everything became accessible and even personal. Yet, in the 20th century, homicides became easy too, as weapons of mass destruction and ideologies of mass extinction were not only conceived but also implemented. The intensification of the ego that unfolded in Babylon and prompted Abraham to develop his technique of uniting above it reappeared in the 20th century, but thousands of times more potently. Worse yet, the worldwide intensification of the ego caused every major crisis to become a global crisis. This was true especially of wars and genocides. During the second and third decades of the century, the Ottoman Empire murdered and deported approximately 1.5 million Armenian people. Between 1921 and until his death in 1953, Joseph Stalin, leader of the USSR, killed several millions of his own people and sent tens of millions to gulags, forced labor camps, allegedly for dissent to the communistic regime. But nothing compared to the Holocaust. As described in the previous chapters and in thousands of books depicting the evolution of the Nazi ideology of superiority of the Aryan race and the incorrigibly vile nature of the Jew, World War II and the Holocaust as part of it set a precedent. This was the first time that a leader and a nation resolved to exterminate the entirety of the Jewish people, at least in Europe, but eventually the world over. Worse yet, as we saw above, for the most part, the Germans' efforts met with no resistance on the part of the nations under their control. In fact, in many cases, the Nazis even relied on the active assistance of local people in their efforts to eliminate the Jewish people. Clearly, the 20th century marked a new level in the cruelty of humankind, especially toward Jews. Having experienced the Holocaust, we cannot be certain that it will not happen again. If it happened once, it can happen twice or thrice, and globally, mounting hatred towards Jews and towards the State of Israel proves that the fear of a second Holocaust is well-founded. This once again reminds us of the necessity to return to Abraham's method of uniting above our differences, and of our duty to set an example to the world by so doing. Interestingly, in the face of growing anti-Semitism in Germany, even before the Nazis came to power, some leading Jews already linked the hatred toward them with the disunity among them. Dr. Kurt Fleischer, the leader of the liberals in the Berlin Jewish Community Assembly, argued in 1929, "Anti-Semitism is the scourge that God has sent us in order to lead us together and weld us together." Regrettably, the awareness of the linkage between anti-Semitism and internal disunity did not penetrate deep enough, and in 1933, when the Nazis came to power, the Jews did not see what was coming and what they ought to do about it. Today, we know where things will go. We have seen the precedent, and we know that we must what we must do in order to reroute them. Dr. Fleischer was not the first, and certainly not the most vociferous voice warning about anti-Semitism. Before World War II, and in fact, even before World War I, there were Jewish leaders, both secular and religious, who predicted a calamity more horrific than ever before. In the early 90s, 900s, rather, Rav Kook, who later became the first chief rabbi in Palestine, wrote, "In Israel is the secret of the unity of the world." Moreover, he stressed the role of Israel in achieving this unity. Humanity deserves to be united into a single family. At that time, all the quarrels and the ill will that stem from divisions of nations and their boundaries shall cease. However, the world requires mitigation whereby humanity will be perfected through each nation's unique characteristics. This lack is what the assembly of Israel will complement. During World War I, Rav Kook felt compelled to outline the connection he saw between the world's troubles and Israel's unity in his book, or what he wrote, The Construction of the World, which is currently crumpled by the dreadful storms of blood-filled sword. Of a blood-filled sword required the construction of the Israeli nation. The construction of the nation and the revealing of its spirit are one and the same, and it is one with the construction of the world, which is crumbling in anticipation for a force of full unity and sublimity and all that is in the soul of Israel. Yet Rav Kook also saw the perils that the world's growing anti-Semitism posed to the Jews. In his latter years, he wrote, Amalek, Petlura, Hitler, and so forth, awakened for redemption. One who did not hear the voice of the first shofar, or the voice of the second, for his ears were blocked, will hear the voice of the impure shofar, the foul one, he will hear against his will. Completely unrelated, but approximately at the same time, Zev Jabotinsky, leader of the revisionist movement, began to warn that the near future for Polish Jews was black, and that a greater disaster was about to befall them. The volcano will soon start to emit its annihilating flames. I see a terrible picture. The time to save you is running out. I know that you cannot see this, because you are occupied with day-to-day concerns. Listen to me at this hour, the midnight hour. For God's sake, let each person save himself as long as there is time, because time is running out. As we mentioned in Chapter 7, Ben-Gurion, head of the Zionist organization in Palestine, was also very worried about the future of the Jews in Europe, particularly in Poland. In 1933, when he returned from Poland, he wrote, "Judaism is being destroyed and strangled. Germany is only a prelude." But the most vociferous among the leaders who warned about the impending calamity was Rav Yehuda Ashlag, the greatest Kabbalist of the 20th century. Back in Poland, he was a dayan, an Orthodox judge, in Warsaw, at the time the largest and most prominent Jewish community in Europe. After he immigrated to Palestine, he became a prolific author of commentaries on Kabbalistic texts, as well as books and essays in political science, politics, international relations, global affairs and trends, and the role of the Jewish people in the world. Ashlag did not settle for publicly announcing that all Jews must flee Europe. While still in Poland, he arranged for the purchase of 300 wooden shacks from Sweden and a place for them to be erected in Palestine. Regrettably, his plan was thwarted by opposition from leaders of the Orthodox Jewish community in Poland, and he and his family were excommunicated. The tragic result of this affair was that of all the Jews who contemplated immigrating to Palestine with Ashlag, only he and his family did so, while the rest of the families remained in Poland and perished in the Holocaust. The memory of the dead and a lesson for the future. After the war, Yehuda Ashlag did not forget his lost family and tribes members who perished in the Holocaust. He also did not mourn them passively. Instead, he continued his proactive attitude of illustrating the role of the Jewish people in the world and what happens when we do not do our part. Ashlag wrote about the need to unite in both secular texts and Kabbalistic texts. In the writings of the last generation, he asserts, "I've already screamed like a crane about this back in 1933 in my pamphlet The Peace, warning that wars today have reached such proportions that they endanger the life of the entire world." Needless to say, today, after the discovery of and use of atom bombs and the discovery of hydrogen bombs, there is no longer a doubt that after one, two, or three wars, the entire human civilization will be totally ruined, leaving no relics. Similarly, but from a Kabbalistic angle, Rav Ashlag dedicated several pages at the end of his introduction to his commentary on the Book of Zohar to the role of the Jewish people and the consequences of not carrying it out. He begins by saying that according to the wisdom of Kabbalah, humanity is divided into concentric circles that expand from within outwards. From the perspective of the correction of the world from disunity to unity, writes Ashlag, the people of Israel are regarded as the innermost circle. Again, from the perspective of the correction of the world from disunity to unity, writes Ashlag, the people of Israel are regarded as the innermost circle. This means that the correction begins with them and spreads from them to the rest of humanity. In other words, as long as the people of Israel do not begin to shift from separation to connection, neither can the rest of the world. This, in itself, explains why so many people in the world blame Jews for everything that is wrong with the world and with their lives. Ashlag mentions Israel's duty towards the world in several of his writings. In the essay, A Handmaid Who is Heir to Her Mistress, for example, he writes, "Know that a branch that extends from the internality of are the people of Israel, who have been chosen as the operators of the correction." Returning to the introduction to the Zohar, after he describes the concentric circles of humanity as Kabbalah explains them, Ashlag elaborates, saying that since the correction spreads from the inside out, anyone who joins the correction process and helps shift the world from division to cohesion is regarded as being a more internal circle and makes greater impact on the correction of the world. To emphasize this point, he writes, "Do not be surprised that one person's actions bring elevation or decline to the whole world." This means, according to Ashlag, that one who works on increasing unity in the world affects the entire world and not just one's close environment. In the early 1950s, when Ashlag first published this introduction, most people could not understand him. Today, when globalization and interdependence are a recognized fact of life, the validity of his words is in plain sight. Nonetheless, it should be noted that when Ashlag speaks of unity, he is not referring to being well-mannered. Quite the contrary, he speaks of revealed hatred, just as we see appearing today throughout the world. yet covering it with love, in line with the principles by which the ancient Hebrews aspired to live. In this regard, we should reiterate the astounding recommendation of Henry Ford in his anti-Semitic composition, The Internal Jew. Modern reformers who are constructing modal social systems would do well to look into the social systems, system under which the early Jews were organized. Returning to this principle, Aschlag explains, is the only way to maintain sustainable unity and establish a prosperous society. After he explains the structure of humanity according to the wisdom of Kabbalah, Aschlag details what would happen if Israel do not do what they must, namely initiate the correction of the world through unity above hatred. To do this, Aschlag references a special part of the Zohar known as Tikkuni Zohar, the corrections of the Zohar. He refers particularly to the correction number 30, which states that if Israel do not carry out their task, then they, Israel, make all the ruin and the heinous slaughter that our generation had witnessed, a reference to the Holocaust. Later, Aschlag continues to reference Tikkun number 30, which says about Israel that when they are immersed in selfishness, they cannot even do good deeds with the right intention. In the words of the Zohar, all their mercies are as the flower of the field. Every mercy that they do for themselves. At that time, concludes the Zohar, the spirit leaves and will not return to the world. Later, Aschlag concludes his quoting of the Zohar, "Woe unto them who cause the spirit to leave the world and not return to the world. Woe unto them, for they cause poverty and ruin, looting and killing and destruction in the world. Woe unto them, for with these actions they bring about the existence of poverty, ruin and robbery, looting, killing and destructions in the world." Continuing to explain that the well-being of the entire world depends on Israel's willingness to unite and allow the spirit of unity to flow to the rest of the world, Aschlag stresses even more the outcome of not doing so. Again, he does this using our own Jewish sources, in this case, the Talmud. In such a generation, when Israel do not correct themselves through unity, all the destructors among the nations of the world raise their heads and wish primarily to destroy and kill the children of Israel. As it is written, no calamity comes to the world but for Israel. This means, as it is written in the above Tikkunim, that they, Israel, cause poverty, ruin, robbery, killing, and destructions in the whole world. But Aschlag does not end the introduction in despondency or dejection. Rather, he ends it with hope and a proactive approach. After we have witnessed, through our many faults, that all that is said in the above-mentioned Tikkunim, and moreover, the judgment struck the very best of us, he writes, and of all the glory that Israel had in the countries of Poland and Lithuania, etc., there remains but the relics. Now it is upon us, relics, to correct that dreadful wrong. Each of us, remainders, should take upon himself, heart and soul, to intensify our unity and give it its rightful place. And latterly, Aschlag quotes Prophet Isaiah in order to describe what will happen if Israel do carry out their task, unite, and stream unity through the rest of the circles of humanity. Then all the nations of the world will recognize and acknowledge Israel's merit, and they will follow the words, and the peoples will take them and bring them to their place. And also, and they will bring your sons in their arms, and your daughters will be carried on their shoulders. This will be the end of anti-Semitism, the end of war, all wars, and the dawn of a new era, of a new and blissful era. Sorry. At that time, so the leaders of our nation have stressed throughout the ages, we will be as we were meant to be, and the nations will say once more what they had said in the days of the Second Temple. as they would go up to Jerusalem and see Israel and say, it is becoming to cling only to this nation.
Shilot.
Questions?
Zasium.
This is the conclusion.
Yenevich.
Yes, Levich.
What is
to ask about dissemination, following what we discussed, or rather following what's written in the book? Today, in the age of the internet, relationships between people became public. It's always online. You can see it. It's apparent, the hostility within the people, and it's very apparent in there. The question is, if we're talking about making connection more important, see more important, can we in practice connect and put unity? Can we actually become like agents of unity? I see that sometimes there are all sorts of storms, fights, conflicts online. Perhaps we can add the sentence which in order to achieve balance, to connect people.
Yes, of course it's worthwhile. Wherever there is friction and conflict and fighting, or even just people getting farther apart, we should show ourselves as wanting to calm down and connect. A little bit here, a little bit there, yeah, that's worthwhile. Very much. But all those things require being organized. It's not just doing it in a way that can even bring harm. Yes.
Yeah, so exactly because of the quantity of it, I'm sure that if we organize such a thing, then it's not only our guys who feel connection is important will join, but it's something around which we can truly add. I mean, if you speak positively, you can gain a following of people who think the same.
Of course, yeah, that's what we need to do. More?
Canada.
So, the people said,
he says here, my problem is, he writes here that about this mysterious verse in the Zohar talking about peace and love, then he says that the method of correction is to go above hate. Look, even those who study the wisdom of Kabbalah don't understand these verses. How can you convey these things to regular people? Because we don't really understand what he writes. The person who isn't there doesn't understand what it's all about. He talks about love, hatred. How do you actually do it? And how do you impart the right energy to the people, to the world?
There's no doubt that there is a place to elaborate here and explain what it means that love covers all crimes. We don't delete the crimes, it's impossible. And humanity makes a mistake in wanting to eliminate the crimes and then achieve something. But rather, when we cover the crimes deliberately, with open eyes, then we come to a state where all the forces come to balance. Where both the negative and the positive begin to show themselves as necessary. That it's impossible to have connection without inner rejection and hatred. That inner hatred cannot come to any solution and bring any benefit if there's no connection and love on top of it. So these things have to become somewhat understood. And that requires explanation. That's still missing.
What did Baal Sulam expect when he wrote all this? He wrote it very nice. This is the pure wisdom of Kabbalah, what he writes here. Connection above the hatred, it's difficult. What did he expect? Let's say that all humanity, or at least Israel, or He expected someone to feel this, right? Because so long as you don't feel it, you can't relay the message.
Everyone has to reach a state where hatred gives birth to its own resistance, and everyone starts connecting to the point of love. This is the realization of not just the wisdom of Kabbalah, but the whole plan of creation.
Then what will happen in the span of time until we reach the point you're talking about, right? It's frightening. Until we get there, what?
So first of all, we understand this is what we have to do. Then we advance some more, some less, in different ways, in different circles. When the moment you start working towards that, just try. And you see, you'll see how effective that is, how that receives support from above. This is called that the dwelling place carries its carriers, meaning you don't need to make additional efforts. The moment you move towards it, you intend towards it, it's already happening.
So it's all about our efforts, right? We don't need to actually be there yet. As we make an effort, all these decrees will be cancelled, right?
This is called the Creator will finish for me.
So we have a chance, you say?
Not a chance. This is how it works. That's the law of nature. Because you have no way to make actions by yourself. There's no way. Only with your little effort, like what's expected of a child. And then all the rest is done for him. You're not demanded to do this based on the plan of creation and the whole structure of the worlds. All we need to do is raise mun. More than that, we can't do. And even that mun we raise is only according to our degree. We don't understand. Whatever we don't know. It's only according to your degree. If you raise a request, then great forces of nature begin to work. That's the whole thing. That's what it's all about. But if we relate to this seriously, understanding that this is how the system works, then there's no problem, and we don't lack anything, because all we need to do is just slightly activate the system. There's a huge machine that works, but all you need to do is just press the button. So what's the problem? Even a child can press a button.
Nice. So at least as I see it, I see people making an effort. I see everyone on the screens. I've never seen anything like that. It's a sign that we're truly advancing, right? According to what you say, then the troubles won't fall on us as badly as you say.
I'm not saying that. You're saying that. I'm saying that there's a lot of actions of connections that are up to us to do, and we ourselves also have to attain the connection above the rejection, and mostly indifference, mostly above indifference, and also show this to the whole world. And then you can say that calamities won't come. They won't come because instead of them, connections will appear. You'll start seeing finally that the whole world realizes that the people of Israel is not a nation. It's a pioneer part of humanity that has to begin the correction process. And all the rest of the world understands that they have to assist and complete the correction. And everyone will become clear, will realize clearly that it's a single system. But like Bala Sulam writes, first there has to be a group, a small group, who couldn't start this unique process. And then everyone, after that, everyone else receives the urge to do that and join that.
I think the book was written in English, but I think that in the explanation about the history of Israel, it's important to emphasize a little the state of Israel today, you know, the center and the periphery, the rich and the poor, the secular and the religious, We say that it's dangerous today, the situation is dangerous today too, but in America it's felt more. There's a big rift between the Democrats and the Republicans, but in Israel the book doesn't make it clear.
Yeah, a sentence or two, but I don't think that you really need to harp on that, because it stings everyone's eyes anyway. So just to mention that sentence, in a sentence, yeah, that's true. But not more than that. More? That's it? Okay. With this, we finished the book. Now what I'm asking you, that everyone will feel obligated to write a summary. To write a page of summary. Everyone is obligated to write a page of summary. From tomorrow until the end of the week, I receive these summaries here before the lesson. If you don't have a pen and paper, turn to me as well. So everyone. You hear, Rami? You're looking at the pole there, I see. Understood, yeah? And now we're moving to?
Perhaps we should read something. It's a nice addition to close the chapter, so to speak.
What?
From the Ummah. The first part there.
All right, let's see. That's in your opinion. Oh, we have questions. Wait, so first of all, questions.
Moscow.
Более-менее понятно насчет того, каким образом строить любовь.
It's more or less clear the way in which we build love above the hatred and how we cover the hatred with love. But what to do with indifference?
It's explained that indifference is because one does not yet feel the press of development that he's going through. He doesn't feel it yet. It's something temporary. Still, as much as he wants to advance to the realization of his life, then he needs to understand that only through the connection he achieves this.
As
much as he understands that the general correction of the world demands connection in his family, everywhere. You don't need more besides connection between all the parts of creation. The moment we realize this between us, then certainly it falls into place across all human society and the still vegetative inanimate. So we just have to further explain to show that this is the place for success, and the indifference to this is the place of ruin and disasters that will come. We had Kiev there.
Доброе утро, Раф. На самом деле вы замечательно подытожили в ответ Цвике, но все-таки вот.
It was a nice summary, your answer to Tzvika, but the whole book is about that. Yes, but still, I want to ask, what is this unity? A person who doesn't know Kabbalah. What should he aspire to? What is that unity he should aspire to?
He needs to understand that the connection of all of nature is necessary. And that what, that's what needs to happen in our days. He needs to understand that the whole of creation began from, let's say, the Big Bang, and various explosions and pieces of matter expanding away from, distancing from each other. And now things are moving back towards connection. And that's where the law of creation is taking place. And it's and it happens by in a necessitated way. Everyone is forced to connect. And we see this in nature across the planet. And if we don't do that, then nature will force us to do this very harshly by way of suffering. And that's not worthwhile. To the point that we can understand from Bala Sulam that we can see atomic wars and then thousands of years until humanity recovers and once again evolves to absorb that disaster and then have clarity on what's going on. What the mind doesn't do, the time does. This means that if a person doesn't want to advance by himself, if man doesn't want to overcome the challenge and achieve the correct states, then troubles and suffering force him to. So, through the group, in the good states that we have today, we'd rather reach a state where we draw the force that connects us from above and reach a good life, happiness, beyond the boundaries of this world, rising to the first spiritual degree. That's already a different thing, where we understand and see what's ahead of us.
Italy. Italy.
Can you hear me? Rob, can you hear me?
Please. Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Ieri Terence ha parlato di una storia che è successa nell'aereo che parla di un ebreo.
Turn off your speakers. Your monitors. Turn them off.
Tomorrow Terence speak about some story in the airplane or about a Jewish. Yesterday. Sorry.
No, that's Allah. No,
that's yes, Allah. And?
Okay, yesterday, Terence speak about some story in the airplane about a Jewish.
Continua, se ha sentito Rav.
E la storia parlava di questo tipo di ebreo che è molto... molto strano questo comportamento. La domanda è: questa particolarità del popolo ebraico appartiene anche al popolo di Yashar Kel, ossia questo ego che cresce in maniera dismisurata, appartiene anche al popolo di Yashar Kel? Anche loro hanno
questo problema.
The question is, this odd behavior he encountered on the plane, can it also reach Yashar El, this quality?
The people of Israel, no, if it's just a Jewish person, then yes, we can be the worst because of the great ego that exists in this nation, and if we correct it, we can be a good example. for the world. It all depends on whether it's before or after the correction. So it's not a wonder that you see such behavior. It's very possible that he saw in a Jewish person. And that is the common flawed Jew that you see. However, if you correct, if the Jew is corrected, then through him you can actually receive the force that connects us together and unites us and raises us above corporeality. So it all depends on the level of correction.
He asked if this can be attributed not only to Jews by birth, but people who have this inclination of Yashar Kel, do they also have this rudeness and...
A certain rudeness exists in Jews from birth. But it's not rudeness in the egoistic sense, by way of trying to use the power of the fist to kill, but rather more on the human level.
So he asks not only about Jews, but people who have the same desire, Yashar Kel, like our friends in Bnei Baruch, not Jews by birth, but people who have the same desire. Does it happen to them also? Or?
Of course. Of course. What's the difference between Jews or those who are non-Jews and are now in the spiritual process? I don't see differences. If the desire to discover the Creator is growing in them, that desire didn't yet go through connection with others to build the infrastructure for the Creator, that means they're still in the evil inclination in the meantime, meaning under the negative egoistic system. And so there's no difference between them and other Jews. What are Jews altogether? It's just that layer of humanity that detached from humanity more than 3,000 years ago, and that's it, and became a group called Israel, straight to the Creator. But it's not a nation, as the Torah says as well. It's not a nation. It's a group. Sometimes it is referred to as a nation, but it's not a nation according to the common definitions. No, it's a collection of representatives, let's say, of all nations who came together in their inclination to discover the Creator between them. And if they don't intend to connect so as to discover the Creator, the force of bestowal and love, then they're the worst from everyone, because they have received an additional will to receive, in addition to all the Babylon, to what the Babylonians had, in order to seek to search for something else in life. And if they don't realize that desire, they become worse, of course. They're the worst. You see how they manage to succeed in all kinds of things in this world. Why does it happen? Because they have an enhanced, an amplified will to receive.
Okay.
We will now continue. So we are moving to... Wait, yes?
On one hand,
anti-Semitism is increasing, and we see that there's also interest towards the wisdom of Kabbalah all over the world. In Africa, in Turkey, there's new campus opening. So how do these two things affect each other?
The wisdom of Kabbalah nevertheless describes the laws that are hidden from us but exist in nature. And with the help of these laws, we can break through to the upper level of nature, where the network of forces exists which operates our world and our reality and our whole universe. And besides that, it accompanies us before we are born into a body in this world, where we exist before birth as a reshimo. What's a reshimo? It's a unique energy, information, data that later it becomes realized in this world, and then loses this corporeal clothing and once again stays as information, energy, what we call reshimo. So all these things are explained in the wisdom of Kabbalah. So humanity, when it comes to levels of development that it's at today, is drawn to that. I think that this generation, specifically in the coming years, let's say the next 10 years, you'll see how the younger people especially will feel that this is what they're lacking. Also, in terms of the development towards the new technologies, and also with regard to the corporeal life, they feel they got not much to do in this world. They're already moving away from corporeal goals. But they go to their spirituality, let's say, this virtuality, and they'll find that there's nothing there also. So this is the time when we need to explain the wisdom of Kabbalah in their language, in the language of the younger generation.
Yesterday, some friends from Moscow asked how to disseminate this book or the concept of anti-Semitism, how to talk about it, and you said that it will be dangerous for them. So perhaps it is possible, perhaps you can explain to us how to tell what country needs to disseminate what things there's, what differences there are between different countries, and what's more appropriate for each place in the world, or I don't know how to put it. There are 70 nations, and we heard several times that they have different nature. So, how to relate to specific nations, how to disseminate for specific nations, and so on?
I don't know. That very much depends on what country we're talking about. If we can write articles that explain what is the Torah of Israel, that explains connection, that it's about connection, and because Israelis don't spread that, that's why they're hated by all the nations of the world. I'm not even sure that will be properly received or accepted, whether it's in Turkey or in Russia. I don't know. I'm being very careful. To me, the well-being of my students in all these countries is very important. So, I don't know. I don't know. It requires research, learning how to approach the explanation. It's not that simple. But it's doable. It's possible to explain. But again, you say that the Torah of Israel is humane and good, and only the Jews don't know how to realize it, and that's why they're bad. But you're already saying something good about the Torah of Israel. So I'm not sure that this will be welcomed in various, layers of the government of Turkey and Russia. I don't know.
So the few years we've had this education center working, we had friends entering our groups and so on, and I haven't seen so much resistance to the wisdom of Kabbalah.
You're talking about people who already come to your course and the like, or you're talking about broad dissemination?
On YouTube as well, we're not getting a lot of rejections and resistance. 7 or 8 years ago, or 10 years ago, there was some resistance to the wisdom of Kabbalah, but now we see everything is much more calm, much more open. It has a logical kind of message. And
all right, continue. I don't know, I'm not an expert in this.
A question about the summary that you said each one needs to write. Can we write in Russian too?
Yes, whatever language you want. We will find a way to translate and learn what we should do next with the text, with this book.
I recommend hearing it in Russian, translated, because maybe the Russians sitting here don't know Hebrew very well, caught, I don't know, 20% of it. In Russian, it'll be much...
How in Russian? Ah, you heard it through translation.
Okay. Yes, yes, yes. It opens up the depth of the book.
If you hear in Russian?
In Russian, yes.
Such a good translation.
In Hebrew, I don't know, it was impossible for me to follow...
Okay.
And another question. One of the recommendations given was to add a certain summary to every chapter. Is that going to happen?
After each chapter, I don't know, but this is what we want. We want you to write a summary for the whole book. It's good. Try. We want it to remain in us as some observation on the process that the world is going through. The action of the fathers is a sign for the children. That's how it needs to be. Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City.
Shalom, shalom, dear friends. Shalom, Rav. The question is, it says that through the book of Zohar, the people of Israel will come out of exile. How the nations of the world can gather the Jewish people around the book of Zohar by the good way of Hishena? How can we help it practically? Thank you.
If you come closer according to what we talk about, the connection in the group, and through the connection in the group to the wisdom of connection and the wisdom of Kabbalah in general, then the nations of the world will feel that and help you along the way. Okay, Rishon.
The book
presents a claim saying that if the books are disunited, if they're not doing their role in the world ejects them, expels them, even destroys them. So the book brings examples of the results following this claim, which are hatred towards the Jews and their destruction. Also, the book claims it's a natural law, meaning that if we do the opposite, if we connect, the world accepts the Jews, embraces them, and they carry the Jews on their shoulders, and they bring balance to the world. Now, if the book presents only one side of the argument, right, the Jews must connect or else, the Jews must stop mixing with other peoples or else, right, the book may be perceived as a bit extreme, even fanatic.
And you will write what you want to say on a single page, like we said, and don't tell us now all your thoughts. I thought you had a question. If you have a speech, then pour it on the paper. Haifa.
Good morning, Av. First of all, big thanks to Chaim for this historical journey across history he took me on with all the rest of the friends. I saw many of my family and many of my family members who were part of those stories, unfortunately. So about anti-Semitism, does the lack of connection begin in the ten? He's asking if anti-Semitism starts with the ten or not.
Of course. Okay. Of course.
All right, so our attitude towards anti-Semites, it sounds like a negative attitude towards them. So I think the worst anti-Semitism, it's actually, well, it's in us Jews. Those who push us to connect, they are doing good work, right? It sounds like a kind of paradox.
Okay, we'll stop discussing these things now. You guys are too smart. Write. You'll write, and then we'll accept these things and discuss them. Discussions over the book, it's not for now. We are moving to the writings of Baal HaSulam. In Hebrew, page 769.
כן, נעבור לחלק הבא של השיעור.
Continue to the next part of the